Welcome. You found the People of Chattanooga podcast. I'm your host, Luke Swab. Today, I have a fantastic episode. Super special to me. So here's the deal. I am a salmon commercial fisherman in Alaska, and I am leaving Chattanooga for the next 7 weeks. I don't like to talk about myself much in this podcast, but I am a part of this podcast because I'm the host, and I thought this episode would be very relevant because I'm talking to Thomas Persinger, who was a Bristol Bay commercial fisherman for 2 years. He has a lot of experience in Alaska guiding and flying and doing fly fishing. And he understands my industry because he's been there. And I wanted to talk to him right before I fly up to do my job. So this episode is more for me than anybody else, but it can also give you a little idea of what I normally do and what my job and career has been so far in my life as a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, Alaska. So that's the intro. We really enjoy the conversation. We talk about mud people. We talk about flying float planes. We talk about airplane dangerous stories. We talk mostly about salmon. And hopefully it's interesting for you guys, but it was extremely interesting and satisfying for me and Thomas. So without further ado, here is Thomas Persinger, commercial fisherman in Alaska, living in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Okay, we're live.
Nice.
I got Thomas Persinger. Did I say it right?
Yeah,
you got it. We just talked about how you pronounce your last name.
Yep.
Okay. Thomas Persinger is... Or was commercial fisherman in Alaska. Is that correct?
Correct.
You're also my neighbor.
Yep.
And this episode is also very relevant and fun because I am also a commercial fisherman in Alaska in the same industry, Bristol Bay fishing.
Yep.
Bristol Bay sockeye fishing. And I'm leaving in, less than a week. I'm leaving next Thursday. So in 5 days.
Jealous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you should have came up with me. I needed one more guy this year.
Dude.
And
two kids at home.
And I asked you.
I know. You gave me first dibs.
I did.
Yep.
I did.
Yep.
So how in the world does someone that live in Chattanooga fish in Alaska? How are they a commercial fisherman? How do you start that?
It's kind of a long story.
We got time all evening in a six pack.
Okay.
So we're good.
Okay. So let's see. Let's back it up to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad, it was his 50th birthday and always wanted to take a trip to Alaska. And so we took a family trip to Alaska and primarily went just to see the state. See what it was all about, but also to do some sport fishing. Huge outdoors family, love fishing, hunting, hiking, camping, grew up doing it. And so away we went, and we went to a sport fishing outfit in Lake Clark, which is give or take 150 miles away the crow flies from Bristol Bay. And we went sport fishing, and it was a fly out fishing lodge. So we were in float planes every day fishing just premier trout streams, and got to see my first sockeye run coming up the Kwijak. And, you know, when you're seeing hundreds of thousands of fish over the course of a day pump up a river, you're going, wait a minute, this exists in the world. How have I never read about it? How have I never seen it? Like, what is this? And I fell in love. So trip ended after 7 days. We went back to, came back to Chattanooga. I actually was at Auburn University at the time. I was in my junior year of college. And so I said, I'm going back and doing that. I just got to figure out how I'm going to do it. So having grown up fishing and had done a little bit of guiding around here in the Smokies, just taking family and friends up into the mountains to fish for trout. I just reached out to a handful of different lodges, then just said, you know, hey, this is what I'm doing. I've never worked in Alaska, got no experience. I can run a boat, I can fish, I can talk to people. Like, you know, what do I need to do? The lodge we went and fished at, Alaska's Fishing Unlimited, they reached out to me and basically said, we need a guide next summer, but this is what you got to do. You know, you need to have first aid, CPR, you need to have your six pack, your Coast Guard license.
Yeah, not the stomach.
Right, exactly. And so, because that's not happening anytime soon. I'm working on a dad bod right now.
There you go.
I started just plugging away at the paperwork, got my captain's license, got the certifications that were necessary, and I got a phone call in February of 2008 saying, hey, you're in if you want to be here. You know, you got to be here middle of May. We got lodge work to do. We're getting ready for guests. They'll be here the first week of June.
How old were you at this point?
21.
Wow.
Yep. So I just turned 21. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. And so I went and started guiding and spent my first summer guiding in Alaska, and just got after it and just loved it even more and more. And the guy that I was actually, airplanes, float planes, right?
Right.
De Havilland Beaver. It's the way it works with these flat fishing lodges. It's typically a pilot, a guide, and four or five guests. And so I flew with this one pilot every day, and his name was Martin, and he was actually a Norwegian immigrant.
Oh, so cool.
Dude, Viking to the max. Yeah. Awesome. It turns out he becomes one of my like biggest mentors in life, right? And so I fished with him every day, just fell in love with it more. I was like, okay, here's my plan. I'm going home. I'm going to finish school. I'm coming back. Like, you know, I'm 3 years into a degree. Like, I got to at least finish out. So I go back, get my degree in 2009, and I'm right back to Alaska in 2010, working for the same lodge.
Was the summer break not long enough for you to work for them and go to college?
No. So the way the sport fishing season works is basically you're fishing the full salmon run, plus you got the trout that come in the tail end of it all, right? So you get up there in the middle to end of May, you know, kings start coming in river, you know, where we were fishing on the Nooshigak, you know, by the second to third week of June, we start seeing some kings, usually, you know, 4th of July, you're heavy on them. And then you're right into sockeyes coming in river. And then from there, you get your chums, your pinks, and then your silvers. And then obviously the trout fishing tapers out into September, October. And Alaska's Fishing Unlimited was always one of those lodges that chose to play late just because we had fishermen that come specifically to catch these 10-pound rainbow trout that are notorious in Alaska for, you know, the end of October, eating eggs and flesh, man, right? It's just a carnage world up there. So, I couldn't go back to school that fall. I fished my second season up there in 2010. And
what did you do that that first year you fished and you had to take that next semester off college?
Yep.
That fall semester?
Yep. Yep. Okay. So I had to take that semester off.
And you go back in winter?
So, semester. So I had to take off my fall of 2008 semester, and to catch up with that, basically, I had to do spring, summer, fall of 2009 to catch up and get out in time.
Gotcha.
So, because I wanted to make sure I could fish the 2010 season. And so that's what I did.
Yeah.
And went back, fished one more season as just a guide in 2010. And over the course of that season, just working with Martin again, flying with him every day in the Beaver, he was just kind of like, dude, you kind of have a natural knack for running motors. You're familiar with airplanes. You're careful, like you should think about getting your pilot's license. And you know how it is, once you get the bug, you got the bug, dude. Yeah. Like, it's a, I'm not gonna call it a disease, but once it's in you, you can't shake it. And so that's what I did. I came home and 2000 and I guess it was the fall of 2011 started getting my pilot's license. So here in Chattanooga.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So got my private pilot's license and just a single engine Cessna. Then jumped straight into a high performance tailwheel airplane, a Cessna 185. Did all of my flight training with my tailwheels out in Sequatchie Valley, which was pretty incredible.
That's beautiful out there. Yeah. I can imagine flying out. I've actually flown out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. My neighbor has a plane.
Yeah. So all grass strip, yep, in and out, getting to play in those hills over there, uncontrolled airspace. So you can actually, you feel like you're flying. Like, don't get me wrong, I get why there's rules and regs, but like, there's no air traffic out there, minus some hang gliders.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was incredible. And so I got my tailwheel, my high performance, and then immediately took a road trip down to Florida, because if I was going to do any flying in Alaska, I had to have a seaplane rating.
Ah.
Yeah. So went to Florida to...
Is that the closest place?
Yes, to get certified, because nobody here has a seaplane.
I think there's a guy that has one now.
Yeah. So there might be a guy that has one. There's people that have seaplanes here.
Yeah, and they land in the lake.
They land in the lake and the rivers and stuff, but you got to have, you know, you got to be certified.
Yeah, you got to get trained.
I had to have training. I had to go to a certified flight instructor. The closest person that could do that was in Florida. So went down there, spent about a week, and got my seaplane rating. And I was cutting it close, because I got that seaplane rating in April. It was on a plane back to Alaska in May.
Yeah.
And the guy that, again, Martin, the guy I worked for, he said, dude, I can't cut you loose with guests or anything, but you need to just build hours. And so he had a super club on straight floats, and it was just mine to play with all summer, which is insane.
You could, you didn't have to pay. Did you have to pay for fuel or anything?
It was
you
just,
got to your own Super Cub for a summer?
Yep.
Aren't those the little ones that can take off at 35 miles an hour? It's a two-seater, one in the front, one in the back behind you.
Yep, exactly.
Oh, my. I've been in one once. Yeah.
They're machines, and especially if you get one that's overpowered like I got, you know, like the standard engine in those things is like a Super Cub is typically going to come with like 165 horse. Your standard J3 Cub will come with an 85 horse. This bad boy had 185 horse in it. So it was very capable. You know, you go to, you know, full flaps, you're no joke, 35 mile an hour stall speed, and you can get very short on a lot of things. So yeah, that was what I got to do that summer, you know. So I couldn't fly guests, but I could just build hours. So I would leave in the morning before everybody would, and I'd meet them down at the river, you know, going and getting boats ready, rafts ready. You know, I had time to play in literally what I consider, and I think a lot of people would, like, the most pristine place in the world. You know, Bristol Bay, Alaska, and that surrounding, that whole drainage that makes up Bristol Bay is just, you have to see it to believe it.
Yeah.
And once you see it, you fall in love with it. You know, my wife's not even a fisherman, like, never was, didn't grow up doing it. And she was just like, I get it now.
Yeah.
You know? So... did that season 2011, 2012, 2013, and it got to a place where, you know, I loved it, but I had to kind of make a decision, you know, because it's either this was going to be my life, you know, I was going to do this seasonal work, you know, this May to October grind, taking people fishing, you know, or come home and, you know, think about what's a different life look like. And, you know, the seasons are long. I don't have to tell you, you know, you grind on a boat for 8-10 weeks out of a season, you know, a year. I mean, you're exhausted by the end of it.
Yeah, it's a grind.
Now, commercial fishing is differently, you know, because you're fishing, it's 24 hours a day, more or less. But
yeah,
it's tiring. And so Martin was like, hey, dude, just, you know, take a year off. You know, if you need to take a year off, he's like, you can always come back. You know, jump right back in the seat. You're always welcome.
Was Martin the owner?
Martin was the owner. Yeah. So he
just took a liking to you, and
for whatever reason, yeah, we just got along really well.
Yeah.
And you know, he was encouraging, you know, obviously he was letting me just burn fuel and air time, which is just
an hours and
now, I mean, yeah. So, you know, I walked out of Alaska, you know, with, you know, 500 plus hours of float time in Alaska, which is insane.
Yeah, you were, like, the number one float plane guy in Tennessee, dude, when you came back.
Probably, at least in Alaska time, I guarantee you that. But So I came back and it was just kind of like, I was kind of torn. I was like, do I want to go back? You know, and I came back and I was kind of fumbling, like trying to find a job. Didn't really know where I wanted to land. You know, it's hard to ever, you know, compare anything to that.
Yeah, that so, type of job doesn't translate to like a normal job back
it's,
here.
It's hard, you know, that adrenaline, that adventure, you know, what.
Maybe a raft guide, right? Something, but
I was kind of burned out. I'm not, you know, on the guiding aspect of it. You know, it was just like
the people.
The people were awesome. I love the people. It was probably just like I felt like I needed maybe a change of scenery. You know, it was literally, it's the only job I'd ever had post college. Right here, I was have a degree in supply chain, but I'm flying planes in Alaska and. I just said, you know what? I just need a change. So actually I came back to, so that was in 2013, the end of that season, I came back to Chattanooga and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Had been kind of networking with people in Chattanooga. And I actually ended up doing a lot of volunteer work at the Chattanooga Area Food Bank while I was here, just, you know, trying to find ways to do some fulfilling work while I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I actually ended up getting hired by the Chattanooga Area Food Bank to help start what was called the Harvested Here Food Hub, which was an initiative to try to connect local farmers with restaurants, wholesalers, trying to make our local food system more viable. Because, you know, we have just amazing farmland, agricultural land around here, but...
Yeah, it's a Squatchy Valley.
Yeah, exactly. But there's always a disconnect between your local farms and local farmers and the restaurants. And so we worked on that for 2 years. I was with the food bank, the food hub, from 2014 through 2016. And in the midst of all of that, now here's where we finally come to the end of this story about how I got into commercial fishing. So we're 20 minutes in and now I can finally tell you.
No, that's fun.
The guy that I worked for, Martin, had a mutual friend whose name was Tony, who was a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay. And had been a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay for going on, I think he started commercial fishing there in like 2000. Had his own boat. And basically what he was doing, he was looking for somebody to help him with kind of sales and supply chain. So he has an interesting business in the fact that, you know, he catches the salmon, he sells the salmon. And so,
and that's rare. That's not the normal.
That's not the normal, right?
Yeah. Most fishermen, they catch the fish and they sell to one of about five different canneries.
Right.
But Tony, he does it all. He catches and then processes it himself.
Right. And so I came on with him in 2016 and started helping him, and that's how I ended up commercial fishing for the next two summers. So the summer of 2017 and then the summer of 2018, and then at the end, so in the midst of all of that too, while I was working for Tony, is when I met my now wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's funny, and Tony and I laugh about it now to this day. He was like, man, you know, he was like, I thought you were going to be the one, you know, you were single, you're getting after it. You were working, you know, these like 16-hour days for me. Like it was working.
He messed up. He didn't hook you up with one of those knack-knack girls.
I'm so glad he didn't, man.
He messed up there.
Oh, man. Ugh. But so, yeah, I met Stevie and, you know, life evolved from there. We got married. We've now have two boys, and so there wasn't a lot of, and my job with Tony was required a lot of road time. You know, I was gone, you know, 3 to 4 days a week, working for him, and it just wasn't how I wanted to live my life, with children.
What do you mean you're gone for 3 to 4?
So finding new customers to buy fish, doing some farmer's markets.
So you were working down in the lower 48 for Tony.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So outside of doing commercial fishing in the summer, I was selling fish for him in the, what I guess you would call the off season.
Yeah. Year round.
Yep. And so it was just one of those things. I was like, man, I want to be a present dad.
Yeah.
And so I decided to, Tony and I, you know, we still have a great relationship, and just said, hey, I'm going to this is what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to just go my own way. And that is how I ended up starting my business, which is called Maritime Seafood Company. And I work with a bunch of independent and family-owned fishermen and help sell their fish directly to the customer. So I work with guys that are in Alaska. I work with guys that are down in the Gulf of Mexico and sell their seafood. You know, a lot of those guys, again, they're fishermen, like you said. And, you know, it's not normal for somebody who's a fisherman to direct sell to customers, especially if they're not in your neighborhood, your, you know, your region. So that's what I do now. And yeah, it's, you know, started that in 2000 and, well, I guess it was January 2019 was when we pushed the website live.
So you still get product from Tony?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yep.
What all do you carry?
So I've got sockeye salmon.
Yep.
And king salmon and halibut. And then out of the Gulf.
Who'd you get the halibut from?
It's a co-op that's based out of, I can't even begin to pronounce the name of that.
The port or?
It's like a, it's a native, I could look it up and tell you exactly.
It's okay.
It's a co-op of native fishermen.
Yeah.
And they catch and they sell to a company that's who I buy from.
Sure. Yeah.
And okay. So it comes out of the Gulf of Alaska is where that's the halibut's coming from. But yeah, it's all, you know, 6-ounce portion, individually vacuum sealed, you know, ready to thaw out and throw on the grill. Yeah.
It's good stuff.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you get out of, you said
the Gulf?
Yeah. The
Gulf. Bayou Labatry, Alabama. So is where my shrimp and the crab that I carry come from.
What crab?
It's blue crabs.
Blue crab.
Yes.
That's the one where you, soft shell, where they, you put them in the tanks and they, you wait till their skeleton, exoskeleton falls off and then you nab them.
Yep. So you can get soft shells where they're, you know, when they're molting. Like you're talking, or like what I like to carry is, I mean, don't get me wrong, soft shells are awesome.
Yeah.
They're a lot of work. And what I found in this business is that making it as easy as possible for the customer is the way to go. So actually, I don't even sell live or raw crab. I sell crab cakes.
Okay.
So they are pre-made, you know, they go straight from the freezer into a baking sheet and then you finish them in a skillet and you've got dinner in 30 minutes and they are dynamite. I will get you a pack before you get out of town.
Oh, no way.
Oh, yeah, dude.
I want one so bad.
Yeah. So, so I get my shrimp and everybody's, I think, has probably heard of Bayou Labatry if you've seen the movie Forrest Gump, right?
Mm-hmm,
it's where Bubba came from.
Captain Dan.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's where I get my shrimp from. I get them directly from the guys that catch them down there. They catch them and process them as well. And then the crab cakes, it's a very good friend's mom who has a small business down there. And that's what she does is they get the crabs directly from the fishermen down there. They pick them, they make them into crab cakes and get them ready for me.
If you've never had a crab cake, you're missing out.
Yeah. There. And you get into a debate, right? You know, there's like a Maryland crab cake and then there's like the, you know, a Gulf crab cake, you know, like, you know, my crab cakes are, I guess you want to call them a Southern crab cake, right? So it's going to have like some red pepper and stuff in it like that. If, you know, a Marylander hears this, he's going to be like, what an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, you don't put red pepper in a crab cake. Yeah, but you know what? It's delicious. So I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Hey, whatever. It's like, you know, pizza's the same way. You got New York and you got Chicago. You got your thin and your thick. And it's
right.
Like, they're both good. Can we just, you know?
Yeah, you know, it just depends on where you're from.
Yeah.
And you know what? I guarantee you, though, like, minus like some hardcore Marylander, they if they ate my crab cake, they'd still say it's good. You want to know why? Because it's like 70, 80% crab meat. Like, that's huge.
What else is in a crab cake?
I mean, you know, you're going to have like some binders, right? To keep it all kind of stuck together. So, like, what's in our crab cakes? We've got red pepper. We've got, egg.
We've got
a gluten-free breadcrumb.
Oh, so, that's cool.
Yeah, so they're still gluten-free.
Is that a new thing or?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of a decision we made. You know, it's like, you know, when you get into value-added stuff like that, pre-made stuff like that, you know, not to say, I don't want to say like oh, I carry a product. I'm sorry, the gluten-free community can't have it, right? But if I can make a product that's just equally as delicious,
yeah,
why not? You know, I'm not gluten-free. You're probably, I don't know if you are or not, but like...
I'm extremely gluten-free.
Right, but yeah, exactly. No, no, over here enjoying our Hutton and Smiths and Five Wits beers, so yeah.
Yeah.
So we... yeah, they're gluten-free, so everybody can eat them as long as you don't have a shellfish allergy.
Yeah, so, then you're in trouble.
Then you're in trouble, so...
I can't help you there.
Yeah, sorry. So yeah, so that's how I started, you know, that's how I got into my business and been after it for 18 months now and going into fishing season, you know, jealous that you're going up, of course. Thank you for giving me first dibs, by the way.
No problem.
Yeah, appreciate
it. I'll give you some freezer burnt salmon in trade. I have some 2-year-old salmon I brought back.
Oh, no.
It's still good, I think so.
Is it vacuum sealed?
No, this is what I caught, actually.
Yeah.
I actually caught it, and so, no, I don't have a vacuum sealer. I caught it and cleaned it on my own boat and put it on a tent, put on a tender with my name and a Sharpie written on duct tape, and... then brought it home in my luggage on Alaska Air. Yeah. So, I mean, it's had a rough life.
But
it's mine.
Yeah.
It's mine.
You caught it.
I caught it. I gave a piece to Ed Jones the other day.
Nice. I love Ed. Great guy.
I had him on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of days ago. And he sells your stuff, right?
Right. Yep. So that's out at Nutrition World for those that don't know Ed. Yes. And so, yeah, I've actually known... I met Ed, I guess, when I was going through flight training in 2000.
Yeah, he flies.
Yeah. So we had the same flight instructor, and this was in 2011.
Chattanooga is the smallest city.
Yep.
Everyone's connected.
I never would have imagined I would have known Ed. And even in 2011, like, I really, you know, Nutrition World wasn't even really on my radar, right? But yeah, so that I got to know Ed from flying, and, you know, we had big dreams like a few years ago. You know, I was out at the store talking with him, and we were going to fly his plane up to Alaska. And it was actually, it was one of those deals. I was going up to commercial fish. We were going to fly up there together. And as the time got closer, can't remember if it was work obligations or I just had to get there or if he had stuff to do, but it ended up not working out. And I would bet if we talked to Ed right now, he'd say it would be a pretty big regret on both of our lists. Not to say that we still can't do it.
Yeah.
It will happen. You know, that is still is a dream of mine. It's like, I want to fly to Alaska myself in a little single engine and like pick my way across the Rockies and all the way up.
Explain that trip. I mean, it's gotta be cheaper just to do a commercial flight.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely.
But like, explain if you flew, do you have a plane?
I did.
You did?
Yes.
But, okay.
Not anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how would this theoretical trip work out, and where are the spots you have to go? What's your fuel range and all that kind of stuff?
So depends on your plane, obviously. Yeah. What I had was, you could consider it like the used cars of the used cars of airplanes. I mean, obviously it's still airworthy, right? It has to be if you're going to, you know, fly it.
A
1943 Taylor craft is what I had.
Is that equivalent to, like, I don't know, a 93 Civic? Is that...
Sure. I mean, you know, if it burned a lot of oil.
Maybe an Isuzu Impulse.
Yeah, man. I mean, we're talking, it was a great plane. Like, I'm not going to dog it because, like any plane that's going to be in the sky, if you got an airworthy certificate, it has to be airworthy.
It's got a good prop with no dings in it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it might have a ding or two in it, but that does, you know, as long as no one knows about it, right?
Buff it out.
Yeah, right. It'll all sand out. But yeah, it was a slow airplane. Mm-hmm. It was meant for nothing more than for me to cheaply build hours, you know, and even then I wasn't trying to fly this airplane long distance. You know, it was, a lot of it was just perfecting takeoffs and landings, because this is an easy way to put it. Anybody can fly an airplane once it's in the air.
Yeah.
I mean, you got trim tabs and throttle locks, and you can basically, once the airplane's in the air, you basically can put it on a manual cruise control to where you can take your hands off and you're just flying. It's getting it back down on the ground
Yeah.
is where it all, you know, I mean, comes together.
Probably anyone can even take off.
Yeah, no, okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, like, it's got to be in the air and, like, you know, straight, true, and level.
Okay,
with you
let's
before.
Take that back.
Yeah, yeah, but conceptually, yes, you know, you give it some fuel, you give it some power, it's going to lift off the ground. But the tricky part's getting it back down.
Yeah.
And getting it back down where you actually want it to get back
yeah,
down.
Yeah,
because
it always comes down.
It's going to come down eventually.
Because there's a thing called fuel, and it comes down.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing is when you look at, you know, NTSB crash reports and stuff, 9 out of 10 airplane crashes are pilot error.
Mm-hmm.
And it typically is a fuel issue.
Really?
Yep. Run out of fuel.
Run out of fuel.
Yeah. Very rarely does a cable break or landing gear sticks or a flap goes, you know, that again, because you have to have this airworthy certificate, you know, from the federal government says, hey, my plane's legit.
Yeah.
So very rarely does that happen. It's pilot error. And that's, you know, fuel is a big one. And then also just not being aware of your surroundings, you know, getting yourself into a weather situation that you're not capable or your airplane's not capable of being in, or
yeah,
disorientation, you have vertigo. It's a real thing. But yeah, I mean, essentially landing an airplane is nothing more than a controlled crash is what it is. And, for those that don't, you know, can't wrap their head around that one. So an airplane is, you know, you're creating positive lift, right? That's what's keeping your airplane in the air. You know, speed, lift equals flight, right?
Yeah, which is the whole concept of the wing, which is the air underneath the wing flies faster than the air above the wing, pushes you up.
Mm-hmm. And so basically when you land an airplane,
you don't want to be going up anymore.
Right. You are literally trying to break that level of flight right as your wheels touch the ground.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to think of it that way.
Yeah, and that's what it is.
Yeah, it's not even thinking of it that way. That's just like being explained.
Yeah, and it takes a lot, you know, when you learn to become a pilot. And I think this is probably what Martin saw a lot of in me when we were, you know, because I was spending, you know, hundreds of hours every summer with him flying around and just watching gauges and watching how he was doing things. And, you know, that just that sheer, like that view that you have out of a cockpit when you're looking to land. And that's huge. Just that distance of like, oh, I'm in the air, but looking at the ground, what is that? Is that 50 feet? Is that 100 feet? You know, is that 400 feet? You know, oh, I got to try to clear some trees. Now I got to try to land in a river. Oh, I got to, you know, there's a lot of variables. Oh, wow. The lake or the river is glass calm. It looks like a mirror. So now what am I trying to land on, you know? And there's methods for how you land and that kind of stuff. And
what about landing in a river that's moving? Are you wanting to land upstream versus up current or down current? Or,
you know, it really doesn't matter because everything is predicated on the wind direction.
Okay.
So wind is your best friend / worst enemy in flying, and especially with a plane that's on water. You know, if you're on land, if your airplane has wheels on it, right, you got gravity, you've got brakes, like you've got the ability to stop. If you're on the water, I mean, you're nothing more than a glorified weather vane, literally. I mean, the wind is going to dictate more or less which direction you're capable of going. And so, yeah, ideally, yeah, I'd love to land going into the current. That means I can stop faster, but I'm not going to land with a tailwind. And if I have a crosswind, I'm just going to take whichever direction's more favorable. But yeah, I mean, landing in rivers is pretty gnarly. I mean, fortunately in Alaska, for the most part, most of the rivers that we were landing in, the lakes that we were landing in, they're clear. You know, you can see, you know, trees, rocks, stuff like that. And obviously you do flyovers, you fly low, you look down, you see what's in there, like, oh, okay, cool, there's a massive rock 30 yards offshore right there, I better make sure I'm stopped before I get anywhere near that thing. And then yeah, once you're on water, you have water rudders, which you drop down into the water, and it's essentially like a paddle basically that hangs off the back of your float that is hooked to the pedals of your airplane that's hooked to your rudders. So you use your feet once you're on the water to control the direction you're going. And then, yeah, that's it. And same thing. But, you know,
and Florida didn't have any rivers with any current to practice. I'm assuming.
So. It was all like potholes, like pothole lakes that you're practicing in, which was great for learning how to do like glassy water landings, coming over trees landing. But yeah, like as far as a practical application of landing in a current, no, it was just, you know, I went to, you know, so after I went back up there and started flying, I flew with Martin quite a bit at first just to get accustomed to what I was doing. You know, it's just a different ball game. You know, it's like being in the classroom and then being thrown to the real world, you know, and when you're being thrown to the real world in an airplane in remote Alaska, I had an old timer tell me this, my first year working in Alaska, who was also a pilot. He said, don't make any mistakes because your first mistake might be your last, which is so true. You, I mean, you know what the water's like up there. It's cold.
Oh yeah.
Even in the bay, man, like that current that, I mean, when those tides shift in Bristol Bay, that's gnarly, dude.
It's 55 degrees or so, and they're the second largest tides in the world.
Yeah, we're talking 25-foot tides.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so much water that's coming
down.
They're
ripping three, four knot currents, you know?
Yeah.
And it changes directions, and it goes the other way, three, four knots.
Yeah. Just think about it. When you're on the line out there in the bay and everybody's stacked on top of each other and everybody's just drifting, you know, perpendicular with that current. And it's just like, I mean, well, you know what it's like. It's a friggin' rodeo out there, you know, nets getting tangled and people cussing. And
rodeo is the polite way of putting it.
Yeah, the very polite way of putting it.
It's like a demolition derby times like a riot.
Yes.
mixed with, I don't know, Black Friday.
It's like, yes. It's like, and like 1,000 dudes that haven't seen a girl in 6 weeks. It's like, aggressive.
So aggressive.
Yeah. Very aggressive.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. If you could hang truck nuts on boats, Bristol Bay would have the biggest truck nuts.
No doubt. No doubt. I mean, that place is special. I mean, I think, actually, I brought this. This is just like a little card, you know, which I think is cool. That's like the Bristol Bay Association that's up there. You know, like those are the guys that are representing all the Bristol Bay fishermen that are up there. And, you know, for those that aren't familiar with Alaska and Bristol Bay, and, you know, Bristol Bay is home to the world's largest salmon run.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah. It's a huge deal. I mean, and not just one species or two species, you know, all five just come plowing up into that bay every year.
It's somewhere around, I mean, it varies, but 20 to 50 million fish come to this armpit of a bay that consists of five rivers.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. Do you know much about the Pebble Mine Project?
Oh, man, dude. Don't get me started on that. I mean, we can get started on it.
Get started. Let's talk about that. That's important for people to know about what's happening with that.
Yeah. So, God, how long has this been going on? This is the early 90s?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think
every year we talk about it.
It's a constant battle, and it ebbs and flows with, you know,
who's in leadership.
Like, politically, who's in office. And
EPA and...
But basically, Pebble Mine, so like we've been talking about, you got Bristol Bay, right? Which is home to the world's largest wild salmon run. All those rivers.
Anytime you get wild Alaskan salmon, it's not anytime, but most of it. Nine out of ten. You go to Whole Foods and you get sockeye that's wild caught. Or better yet, you go to Nutrition World. Well, if you go to Nutrition World, you're getting
Bristol Bay fish.
You're getting your fish.
Yeah, you're getting my fish.
Yeah, you're,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. But yeah, all of those rivers that make up Bristol Bay have to start somewhere, right?
Yep.
Just like here in
watershed.
Yeah, it's a watershed. You know, rivers that drain off the Great Smoky Mountains make their way to the Tennessee River that makes their way to the Mississippi, etc.
Right.
But it's the same thing up there. You know, these four or five rivers that you're talking about all are comprised of these little streams and wetlands that start hundreds of miles north. and basically at what I would consider the heart of Bristol Bay. You know, basically the water that comes from, that drains to the Nooshigak, to the Kwajak, to the Naknek, to the Alagnak, all of that comes back to this one place that's just to the west of Lake Iliamna, and it is home to, hopefully never, the Pebble Mine, which the Pebble Mine is, has the potential to be the world's largest open pit strip mine for gold, copper, and was it molybdenum? It's an additive that goes in, I think, for steel, basically. But those three make up this mine. And, you know, there's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of minerals that are under there. And in order to get those minerals out, they have to scrape the surface of the earth away. When you do that, you upset the water. You know, you're going to taint the water. It's going to get muddied. You know, you're going to have traffic. You're going to have pollution. I mean, and on top of that, with every strip mine comes what's called a tailing pond, which is after they mine all this gold, copper, and everything out, it has to get literally run through a chemical bath that separates those minerals from the dirt and everything else. And then that water is so dirty, it can never go back into this ecosystem. It has to go into this tailing pond where it literally has to be stored and maintained forever. Forever. I mean, there's no way to clean it. It is literally there forever. And on top of all of this, if you don't know about Alaska, there's a bunch of volcanoes up there. It is part of the Ring of Fire that swings out over the Aleutian Chain. Like, that is, we are on a seismic line. There was a volcano 2 years ago, Iliamna. One of those volcanoes blew 2 or 3 years ago. Because I remember being up there because it shut down like Asian airspace, like Japanese airspace, because they couldn't fly because the volcanic ash that was in there.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
One. Yeah.
And so, okay, cool. Let's put the largest strip mine with the largest tailing pond in the world in a very seismic area.
That's in the backyard of the largest salmon, the largest wild caught salmon industry in the world.
Yeah. And then people go, oh, like, well, what does that have to do with salmon? Well, how do you know, you got to understand the life cycle of salmon now, right?
Yeah.
So salmon are born in a freshwater stream. They're what's called an Andromedas fish. So they're born in freshwater. They live in freshwater for a year or two. Then they migrate down those rivers out into the ocean where they grow, and they grow exponentially. They leave the rivers as a 2-inch long, 4-inch long fish, and they come back weighing, if you're a sockeye, 6 to 10 pounds. If you're a king salmon, you could be 8 pounds. You could be 65 pounds. You know, that's your genetics.
And I want to ask you, what's the heaviest king you've ever caught?
The biggest king I ever caught was 45 pounds.
Nice.
On the Nooshigak.
Yeah.
And that was sport fishing.
Right.
Yes. And it was a beautiful, beautiful fish.
Yeah.
And I would like to say that we let it go, but it was a client of mine that actually caught it. I consider any fish my client caught, I consider I caught it, because, you know, I'm more or less, like, I do the fishing for it. I tell them where to go. Yeah. You know, so if I get to put my hands on a 45-pound king,
yeah,
you know, that was my fish.
Yeah.
Even though they caught it and did all the hard work. You know? But yeah, it was a big buck, at least. I can justify that, which, again, is what it is. That was in the Nooshigak, which is one of the rivers that makes up Bristol Bay. But
The life cycle.
Yeah, the life cycle. So they spend that time in the ocean. They come back. Well, what most people don't realize, you know, a salmon that's born in Alaska, it's going to come back to Alaska. And it's not just going to come back to general waters of Alaska. It's going to literally try to find its way back to its natal stream. It's going to try to go back to that exact same creek that it was born in and then do its thing. You know, make its red, lay its eggs, and then die. And, you know, how do salmon find their way home? You know, there's a lot of scientific chatter about what is it, you know, how do they do it, right? You know, well, they say initially they've kind of got this like magnetic, like this compass in their head, right? They, like when they leave Alaska and they leave Alaska waters, there's really no idea of where they go. Do they stay in Alaska waters? Do they swim the Ring of Fire? Do they go all the way out? And, you know, who really knows? They go down to Washington State. Do they come back up? All I know is that they do come back, and they come back very close to, if not the exact river they were born in. But once they get in the river, they literally use their sense of smell to find their way back into that river. I can't remember what it is. I think they say like salmon can smell in like parts per million or something like that, like, or parts per billion or something. It's something ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it makes a dog's nose look pathetic, you know? And so if you go in and you put a mine in where you muddy water up and you taint water, you put roads over water, you block dams, you just trash it with all of this stuff, well, they can't find their way home. If they can't find their way home, they can't spawn again. If they can't spawn again, what happens to the run? Well, inevitably, it's going to die. And that's just for that one specific area, you know? So, yeah, I mean, you know, what I have to say about Pebble Mine is like how corporate greed is unfortunately what drives the most of it. And I think what really like drives me crazy is the fact that the companies that own, I guess you want to call it the mineral rights to Pebble Mine, they're not even American based companies. You know, I think what is one of them's Canadian,
I think Canadian,
and one of them's English maybe, but yeah, I mean, it's like, so, okay, cool. Let's let these foreign companies come in, mine this, make this horrible mine. I would almost go as far as to guarantee you it's going to kill the salmon run. And then we, as a, you know, what do you want to call us, Americans, are left with the aftermath of trying to either maintain this tailing pond or have to clean up all of this, you know, shit that they left. So.
Yeah, I mean, at best, it's not going to help the salmon run. It at best, it wouldn't hurt, but it's not going to help. And but do we want to take that risk? Salmon are going to come back forever. You have that. And then, yes, it's the world's largest mine, but at some point that's going to be empty, and then you're done. And so you have like a resource that has like a finite life and then an infinite life. And right. Like, and I mean, maybe we can mine there for 100 years, maybe 200 years, maybe 50 years, but we can fish salmon for thousands and forever.
Like they have been.
Yes.
Literally have been getting fished
yes.
by cultures for tens of thousands of
so
years.
So what? So it's like, it's so small picture in my mind to even entertain the idea when you can have salmon forever.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I've heard this, you know, saying quite a few times lately, and I want to make sure I get it right, but it's that we're borrowing the earth from our children and our grandchildren, which when you think of it like that, it's like, man, you know, like it's up to me to make sure that like my kids can enjoy what this earth has to offer, like I've gotten to enjoy, you know? And I think that's just a lot of, you start looking at, you know, Native American history or Alaskan, you know, Native history, you know, so much of it was like, not this like give or take. It's like, we just took what we need to subsist and that's it. You know, there's a harmony with like humans and nature versus now where it's just kind of like a slash and burn, grab and go kind of mentality, which I get it. You know, people need jobs and money is to be made, but to like, to the cost of what, you know, is it really worth destroying what I would consider probably one of the last pristine salmon run in the world? Cause I mean, before Bonneville Dam in Washington State got put in that dammed the Columbia River, that was one of the largest salmon runs in the world. You know, I mean, it was right up there with Bristol Bay, you know?
Have you heard much about, there's talk of trying to take some of those dams off of the Columbia River. Have you heard? Do you know anything about that?
You know, not to probably like speak intelligently about.
I mean, don't either. That's why
I mean, you know, I've got friends that live in Washington State that are sport fishing guides out there. And,
yeah.
You know, dams are detrimental to salmon. You know, they can put in what's called a fish ladder.
Yep.
They can try to get these salmon to navigate up this ladder. But like everything else in the animal kingdom, like, okay, cool. Let's like, hey, fish, here's a fish ladder for you to climb up. We're going to funnel you all into this like 10 by 8 foot channel and we can work you around. Well, of course the predators are going to find that and they're going to sit right there on it. So that's what the seals and the sea lions do. They literally sit right on these fish ladders and they eat a lot of their salmon, but what they do is they injure a lot of them. So even if there is a wild caught run, okay, cool. They've made it in. But then once they get in, cool, they've made it all the way up and over this fish ladder and up past this dam. And then they go and spawn. Well, what are the little guys supposed to do? What are the chances of those guys? I mean, salmon are already just like screwed from the get go, you know? I mean, like something's trying to eat them from day one, you know? When they're an egg, there's a trout that's trying to eat them. When there's a fry, there's a char that's trying to eat them. When it goes out into the ocean, everything that's trying to eat them in the ocean. And then when they come back, you got commercial fishermen that are trying to grab them. Then you got, you know, the bears that are trying to get them. And then you got the sport fishermen that are trying to get them. And then they actually manage to make it all the way to their home, make a red, lay their eggs.
And then die.
And then die.
And then die anyway.
Yeah. But, you know, like it sounds so grim that these guys, they spend this 5-year life cycle, come in and die. But like, that's what actually is what made Alaska so awesome. Because without that salmon run over the past eons, like it'd be so barren.
But that's why these salmon aren't letting us know where they go. They're living their midlife. They're partying out there in the ocean for those 2 to 3 years. We don't know what they're doing.
Just grubbing.
Eating. They're at the all you can eat China buffet. Yeah. They're just getting it.
Yeah.
Because they know, you know, it's not going to be that great once we got go back.
Once we come back in, it's going to be a rough run. Yeah. But you know what? That's what's amazing about it, you know? Like, and that's what's cool about, like, you know, the state of Alaska and how they manage the fishery.
They manage it very well.
And you can probably talk way better about that than me about, you know, openers and closers and, you know, escapements and all this kind of stuff, which is awesome. I think it's actually worth touching on, you know, explaining to people like what that means.
Yeah. Well, I can explain what I know about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So escapement. Well, okay. So I don't know how these guys do it, but there's a biologist and they study these runs and they make these predictions of how many fish will be coming back the next year. So say 40 million fish are going to be coming back this year. And just for ease of numbers, we'll say 1 million. So there's four rivers, mostly there's Togiak, but that's like something else, but there's four main rivers. There's Naknek Kwijak, there's the Nooshgak, there's Igigik and Ugashik. And each of those rivers is going to get, let's for ease of numbers, 10 million fish. So they want 10% of those fish to what's called escape and get all the way past the rivers to the spawning grounds. So what they do is they have people at the top of the rivers physically counting these fish as they swim past these, I think it's called a weir, but I don't want to, is that what it's called? Yeah. And there's probably like grad students and stuff up there with actual clickers.
Hand clickers.
Hand going click, click, click.
Yep.
Watching the fish. And so they report to the fish and game and everything. And so at the beginning of the run, it trickles in like you would assume. Like it doesn't all come at once. Like fish, there's some earlier fish. They like getting up early and there's some little later fish and regular time fish. But they start trickling in. And so they're keeping track of how many fish are going up. And they don't want to get – they're not going to let the first million go up and say, okay, now you're good to go. They want to spread this – fish migration throughout the whole season, which is typically about 6 weeks or so. So they have these certain numbers they want to see by certain dates. And as those numbers are being met and they have test boats all out in the bay, and at Port Mulder kind of predicting and seeing huge massive schools coming in because a huge school can come in and just jam the river and kind of surprise everybody and too many fish would get up at that time. So these guys are the Fish and Game uses us as a tool. So if too many fish start to go upstream, they give us what's called an opener. And now we get to fish. And an opener can range anywhere from the shortest one I've fished was 2 hours up until, well, actually 24 hours. So they'll give you an opener, usually around 6 to 8 hours. And so our job, we're a tool. The fishermen are a tool for the Fish and Game to stop the fish. So that's pretty much
because you can have too many fish.
You can have too many fish.
You can. And that's the thing. It's like people are like, oh, hey, you can't have too many fish. You can.
You can because they overcrowd each other. Right. And get in each other's
There's
beds.
Not enough room.
There's not enough real estate up there.
Right.
And for whatever reason, this fishery has been able to grow, find the optimal amount of fish to spawn and get past us so that many more come down and then we can harvest a huge percentage of the fish coming back and keep this stable, sustainable
And it is. Ecosystem. It is a truly sustainable fishery.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. I mean, year after year after year, I mean, it's continuing to produce fish.
So the downside of us being looked at as a tool, we're not necessarily looked at as humans. Humans in the sense that their objective is the fish's health and safety, not the fishermen. So you can be sitting on anchor for 3-4 days waiting to fish in good weather, and then all of a sudden it's going to blow 50 and have seas a chop of 15 feet, and they're like, well, the fish are coming, so now you get to fish for 6 hours and the bad weather.
Yeah.
And you have to.
It's like, well, I got to make a living.
You got to make money, so you go out there, and you get beat up, and it's dangerous.
And typically you get a lot of those big pushes come in on that horrible weather.
The fish love the weather.
Yeah,
the
get that excess water. You get like, and I don't know if it's like that rain that hits that fresh water and it's just that flood of smell and they're like, oh man, we found home. Let's go.
Yeah, the fish, the bad weather days are usually the better days.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I definitely have been on the boat where it's like bluebird, calm,
sure,
and like caught fish. But those days where you're like, you know, shin deep and fish on deck, and it's just like you're getting your ass kicked by these waves and you're rolling around, and you're covered in slime and scales and you're trying to bleed fish and get them in the, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's awesome.
It is.
It's getting me riled up thinking about it.
Yeah.
Dude. Golly.
You want to fly out for a week and be a bonus guy, man. A walk-on?
I would love to. If we could predict like when that peak would hit, I would so jump on your boat for like that week.
I got an extra bunk.
Oh, man, dude.
It'd be good.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing worse than like having that fresh guy that comes in, you know, like... Uh-huh. You know, 4 weeks into season, like all gung ho, and you're just like, dude, screw you, man. I've been living on this like 3-inch cod eating ramen noodles, and like you're way too excited to be out here.
I think I tried that 1 year. They're starting to get fuzzy. I've been a captain since I was 20, and I'm 36 now. So, I think 1 year I tried doing the walk on guy where you had the fourth peak guy, is what they're called. They come in just for the extra hand during that 7-10 days that you need.
Yeah.
I just run a 3-guy crew typically.
Yeah.
Me and 2 guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, considering the state also limits your boat length is 32 feet, right?
32 feet. Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny when you see those boats, you know, that were obviously like 36 and came out of Washington state and the front end of them's cut off.
Yeah. So the fishery is highly regulated, so you can't have a boat longer than 32 feet. But there's no regulation for width.
Right.
So with the industry is doing really well now. So there's been a lot of, there was a time when the industry fell on its face and no new boats were being built for 10 years or so, but now it's back. And, so people are building new boats and they just build them wider and they're getting wider and wider and wider. And I think the widest one I know is 18 feet wide.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 18
That's
feet
luxury.
Wide. Yeah, that half as wide as it's long.
Oh, my gosh.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but, you know, you see these guys that are out there in these multi-million-dollar commercial fishing vessels, but that's what's funny about it. You know, you get these brand spanking new boats. You know, I don't even want to know how much one of these brand new boats cost.
Well, they're not quite multi-million, but I think a year or two ago, they claim they made the first $1 million bay boat.
Okay.
Yeah. One.
So now you got a $1 million boat, though, but then you've also got, like,
Oh my goodness.
Straight up classics that are out
there.
Dude,
there's
some
classics.
Yeah.
Like there's some wood boats.
Wood boats.
There's some guys fishing in wood boats still.
Yeah. And then you, of course, you've always got like your set netters out there. You got your mud people running around.
You want to explain? You want to take that one? So we've been talking about the drifting, yes, where you live on the boat and you fish. But what's a mud person?
Mud people. You know, it all depends on. So sockeye in particular, you know, they run specific routes through this bay, through these rivers, depending on where they're going. And it has everything to do with current. It has everything to do with eddies,
water depth,
sandbars, all of that stuff. And again, there's this whole underwater world that you just can't see. But if you're a fish, you know, imagine you're running a marathon, right? And are you going to pick the lane that's got the most resistance or the least resistance? If you know you're about to have to run a 100-mile long marathon, well, you're going to probably pick the path that's got the least resistance. Sometimes that means that you're going to get up close to shore. And so this is when you get into what's called a set netter.
And you can visualize it as a human, like especially in Tennessee with Sasquatchie Valley and all these gorges and creeks. Like if you want to just get from point A to point B, you're going to look at the terrain and you're going to put elevation into consideration. Mm-hmm. And fish are also putting elevation that we can't see into consideration.
Right. And so they're going to pick that path that makes most sense. And what they'll do is they will hug up on the shore. And when I say, you know, hug up on shore, you know, we're talking, what's the deal with set netters? Can they have three?
How long can
a set netters net be?
I think 50 fathoms.
50.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because a drifter, their permit, you get 150.
150, yeah.
Yeah, you get, what is it, three shackles.
Three shackles, unless you have two permits and then you can have four.
Four, right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they got 50 fathom.
I hope I'm right. I'm going to sound horrible. You are,
no, you're right. I know for a fact you're right.
Okay, good. Yeah, I hope it's not 100.
No. Because I know just good. Shifting gear, you know, when you rotate gear, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're bouncing from one side to the other as you pick nets and stuff. There's always three shackles.
Oh, sure. I know the drift boats. Right. But the set netters, I hope I'm right with that, but I could be wrong.
If you have two permits, you probably can go from 50 to 100.
Well, no, you have different sites.
Right, okay.
Permit goes with the site. I know that one, yeah.
So, basically, a set netter, their net starts on the shore and goes out into the ocean. And they don't have these big, massive 32-foot boats with cabs and all of this. They are typically, you know, these, like, 20-foot skiffs, give or take, mm-hmm. that have, you know, anywhere from 50 to 250 horse outboards on them, and they literally just pull up on the net and go down the net perpendicularly, pick the fish out. Similar setup, you know, they got rollers that come over the sides, you know, they've got brailers, you know, which is the bag that the fish go in, and then from there they run those fish to whoever their tender is.
Mm-hmm. It's called a set net because the net is set still. It's anchored to the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
And we're drift boats, so we float around freely.
And you're floating with the current.
And we can pick our spot we want to fish. But they own or lease a location on land that's fixed. And they start their net typically from the shore. But sometimes they can go out a little further if they want, but it's fixed. And
it's regulated too, you know, as far as if you're a drifter, you can only get so close to these set nets and stuff.
Rules.
Because I'm sure you've done it in your 16 years. You tangle gear. Ooh, man, you want to talk about a cluster. You want to hear some cuss words. Tangle some nets.
Yeah.
Whether you're tangling up with another drift boat or you're tangled with a set net, or it's never pretty, man, because somebody's gear is going to get destroyed, if not both.
Oh, my God.
Losing gear, tearing holes in nets, it's expensive.
The nets are expensive, yeah.
The nets are expensive, but then the time either takes for you to fix holes in the nets, depending on how bad the tear is, versus having to run all the way back to get another, you know, bit of gear. It sucks. But yeah, so mud people, it's kind of a term that's been coined because, you know,
and
they're slopping around in
the
mud.
I think it's been coined by the drifters.
Yes, absolutely has. I'm sure if a set netter listens to this, they're going to be like, God, you guys are such assholes, you know? Yeah. But like,
and we are.
Yeah, I mean, we play.
Yeah.
To each their own. But there are some set net sites. And I've heard this outside of like those crazy years where, you know, what was that, like 2 or 3 years ago when like the Nooshigak set some records and there were some drifters that fished the Nooshigak, then fished the Kwijak and the Knack Knack runs. And, you know, they were putting up, you know, like 400 and 500,000 pounds of fish, which is insane for a single boat. There's some set net sites that like consistently put up, you know, 200, 300,000 pounds of fish every year.
Yeah. Since you own or lease a site, that's where the best sites make the most money. Mm-hmm. So obviously those sites are going to be more expensive to buy from somebody.
Right.
So yeah.
And those permits, it's actually interesting, you know, the commercial fishing permits are kind of like, you kind of call them a stock. You know, they ebb and flow with the health of
the industry.
So, you know, if salmon prices are high, the permit that you own is way more valuable than if, you know, the prices on salmon plunge.
For example, the drift permits, before the crash, I'm trying to remember when this was, because it was late 90s. A drift permit sold for $300,000. Mm. So that was a peak. And then within a couple, it crashed, the salmon issue crashed. And then that same permit, or the value of the permit went down to, I think, $18,000 was the cheapest one sold.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Could you imagine if somebody told me that I could buy a permit, like drift permit for $18,000 right now, I'd take out a loan and go buy that.
Well, my cousin, he bought one for $20,000.
Wow.
That's when I started fishing.
Awesome.
My first year was 2003 and, it was 2003. Yeah. Freshman college, 2003. And, he bought his for $20,000.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And he bought his boat for $20,000, and his boat was probably worth $150,000.
Wow.
I mean, but
hey,
not when the industry crashes, and that's because the price went from $2 and change to a pound all the way down to 40 cents.
Right, and that's the thing that like when you get into like the cost of fish and like how is a fisherman getting paid $1.50 a pound for some fish now? You know, but Publix is over here selling it for, you know, 16, 18 a pound. How am I getting away selling it for, you know,
that's what you can explain to me because you're on that more on that side.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's probably different because, you know, it's kind of like your local farmer's market, your local food scene, right? I pay a fair price for the fish.
Yeah.
To the fishermen that catch my fish. Therefore, my price is higher. Therefore, if I want to make a living, I have to charge a little bit more.
Yeah.
Now, with that comes, like, it's kind of like, oh, I can go buy a steak at, you know, the mainstream grocery store, and it's $8 a pound. I can go to my local butcher shop, you know, and pay $15 a pound for it. But the difference is, one is corn-fed commodity fish, one of it's going to be a grass-fed, live the happy life cow, you know, and it just kind of boils down to, like, what's important to you. Like, at the end of the day, like, don't not eat because you can't afford it, right? But, like, you know, like, I want to not only provide salmon, wild-caught salmon to customers, but I want to make sure I'm giving them the best. I want to make sure that it's supporting these fishermen that are getting their ass kicked for 7 weeks, 8 weeks out of the year, you know, just grinding, trying to catch these fish. I mean, it's worth it to me. And, you know, it's hard. That's probably the hardest part about my business is conveying that message to somebody without seeing them face to face and without them hearing this like huge background to like why these fish are so important. Like, why is it worth it to pay $18 a pound for some wild caught sockeye versus $7 a pound for some Chilean raised Atlantic? And we can get into that if you want,
yeah,
about that whole other story. But for me, you know, the cost of the fish is my money's going back to the fishermen. And that makes me sleep comfortably at night, you know. And I, you know, my customers that buy fish from me, they're buying it because of that reason. A, wild caught salmon is just significantly more nutritious than its farm raised counterpart. And it's got a story, you know. It's like, you know, what was that really? Was that the very first episode of Portlandia, right? Like,
oh, the chickens?
The chicken. And they're like flipping through the book and the chickens have names. And it's like, okay, that's a little extreme. Yeah. But I would rather know that I'm like being like a steward of the land and the sea versus I'm out there just like raping and pillaging, you know? And I know that the folks that I buy my fish from and my, you know, shellfish from, that they're doing right. You know, there's always the potential to break rules and break laws and overfish and do this and that. But like, you know, I know that the guys that I work with are real dudes and they want to make sure that the livelihood that they have right now is still going to be there for their children and their grandchildren. And you got to, if you want to do that, you have to act responsibly now. You know, it's kind of crazy. Like you look at, you know, prime example of like something that's entirely inefficient and doesn't make sense, but it's just the way that the world is right now. But like, you know, mainstream beef is a prime example, right? Like it takes, I can't remember how many pounds of corn. It takes like 3 or 4 pounds of corn to like put on like 1 pound of beef, right? And how inefficient it is to raise that corn, to feed to that cow that takes up all that land versus a cow that like it's going to be a little bit leaner. It's going to live a happier life, but you're going to pay for it because it takes longer to raise. You're not just shoving corn down its throat to get it fat to take it to market. And so I guess what I'm getting at is it's, you know, what's important to you, yep. You know?
And what's cool about the salmon, the wild salmon, we don't have to feed them. Like no. They're feeding themselves. They're wild. Yeah. We don't have to put up nets. We don't have to give them antibiotics so they don't get sick.
Right.
We're just, I mean,
they're living their life.
It's like,
it's harmony.
It's seriously free food from nature that we're grabbing the appropriate amount. So we have enough for next year.
Yep.
It's really a cool thing.
It's incredible. And it's been going on for eons.
Yeah.
I mean,
so we got to keep Pebble Mine out.
Keep
this Pebble is propaganda. Mine out. Yeah. This is a propaganda podcast.
I mean, you know, and I am not one to do politics. I don't
either.
And you know, but man, like Pebble Mine is unfortunately has its hands tied to politics. I mean, they are married to each other.
Have you been to the Pebble Mine Fishermen's Club in Fishermen's Building in Igakik?
No.
Did you know about this?
No.
Pebble Mine bought land and built a building for the fishermen called the Fishermen's Lounge in Igakik, a tiny little community in one of the rivers you can fish at. And us fishermen, we can go up there because a lot of times you can't fish because we're waiting for these biologists to tell us we have an opening. So you're just anchored in this river with absolutely nothing to do. No cell phone service nothing.
Nothing.
No, when I say nothing to do, I mean...
You can read a book.
That's what I mean. You can read a book. You can play the guitar. Yeah. Yeah. Or you can dock up and go to the Pebble Mine Fisherman's Club and watch a movie or play PlayStation or buy an ice cream sandwich for $3 or take a shower for $5 or try to get internet, but every year it's down. But anyway, they spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on that to, you know, try to gain a little rapport from the fishermen.
Oh, that's all they want. They want the fishermen to just shoulder rub them right now. And then they'll be, oh, these are my buddies. You know, I took a hot shower there. I was able to,
And for what it's worth, a hot shower is nice.
It's priceless. I mean, you really can't. I mean, like $5, like when you're like, who would pay $5 for this? What is this, a truck stop? But it's like, dude, when you haven't showered in 3 weeks.
What's the longest you've gone when you did the commercial fishing with no shower?
2.5, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, a quarter of the season, three quarters of the, you know, like, yeah. I mean, but yeah, we're talking like a full shower. Now every day, you know, you're taking baby wipe showers, right? You know, wiping yourself down with sani wipes and everything else.
Sounds like you're on a nice boat that has baby wipes. Dude. Maybe I should get some.
If you don't have baby wipes, holy cow, dude.
I've had baby wipes for years.
Yeah, but you gotta have sani wipes, man. Like, you can get sick from these fit. I mean, like...
Oh, yeah, and you...
Salmon poisoning, yes, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, what is that called?
You get an open cut, and you get that slime, because... So, all fish have that coat of slime on them, right? And that's what protects them.
Yep.
Well, that... It's protecting them, because it's basically catching all of that bacteria.
Yeah.
But it... You know, when you're picking fish, even if you got your gloves on, there's knives everywhere. There's like, you know, monofilament nets. Like, you're going to cut your hands, you know, like, it happens. And you get that bacteria in your hands. Like, you can very easily get an infection.
Did you ever have your hands get real sore and tight?
Yes. Like, what? Within like the first 24 hours of picking a net, you're like, wow, man.
It was a facetious question.
Yeah, your hands get soft in the off season.
Yeah.
They catch up pretty quickly, and you go through that phase, you know, where they like hurt.
I tried hiring a rock climber this year because I thought, with their hands.
It's logical.
Because I needed a new guy this year, and I just thought that would
be interesting to see if you're onto something.
He turned it down. But it was a catch-22 because, and I don't think he'll care if I say this, but he only has 9 fingers.
Oh.
So, like, now...
You need that.
So, now what do you think about that? You know, like, he damaged it in a rock climbing accident, and he lost his ring finger, but he had pretty cool surgery. They took his whole, all the leftover bones clear down to the base of your palm, and then they pulled the pinky over. And his hand looks normal. If you look at it, it looks normal. And then until you realize there's not enough fingers there.
Huh.
And they all work. And he's a fantastic climber. He climbs 5'13".
Interesting.
So, like.
Interesting.
I guarantee you
he could pick
it. I bet he'd be fine.
Yeah, he'd be fine. I'm just sitting here thinking, like, if you're sitting here trying to do this.
So. No, they're spaced correctly.
Right. But, man, I'll tell you what. Like, when you're picking that net, like. Sometimes that pinky comes into play. That 10th finger comes into play.
I know.
Like, pretty often. And I guess it's.
So what is picking fish? Did we talk?
No, like, I don't think we've touched on it. So whether you're a drifter or you're a mud person. You all are fishing more or less what's called, we call it gear. It's the net.
Yeah.
And it is a. Nylon monofilament? I mean, like, it's
a many different tiny strands that make up
a million different strand. Like, they're kind of diamond shaped.
They've got 5 inches. If you pull them together, they're usually anywhere from like 4 4¾ would be really small.
Yeah.
All the way up to like 5 1/8.
And that is, again, regulated by the state to prevent. More or less bycatch to just, you know, it just limits.
Let's talk about bycatch just for a second.
Yeah.
A little side note. Bristol Bay is one of the cleanest fisheries that I know of as far as bycatch. We don't have hardly any.
Yeah.
We don't have hardly any.
It's because it's pretty much a vacant ecosystem.
There's mostly just salmon.
Yeah.
Now, you will catch flounder.
Starry flounders, char.
You will.
Dolly Vardens.
But you don't kill them. You just throw them back in.
Most of them go right through the nets. If I had to guess. I mean, you catch some every
Well,
now
if you
and
fish
again.
On the flat, I mean, I've hauled up a lot of flounder on the flats.
Oh, no, on
like
the
I've
flounders,
had
yes.
Flounder.
Yeah, but I'm
sets,
thinking Dolly Varden, you know, most of those dudes, you know, they can make it through, but those flounders, yeah, when you get up shallow.
Yeah, so you don't, I mean, you're only catching salmon. You get a hair crab once in a while. Did you ever get any of those?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, I've gotten a crab.
But here's the thing, though, and I guess that's worth touching on. This is not like long lining, right? Where it's like
no dredging.
You're not doing something that's super catastrophic and it's just laying there for an extended amount of time. When we're putting our nets out, these nets are out for they're out and they're in and they're out and they're in. Like you set your net, and I mean, what's the longest set you like without pulling it in?
I'm gonna lie and say it hasn't been 8 hours, but it might.
Right, because you were probably just sitting there hoping the fish were coming. But like
a night set.
Yeah,
but no. I mean,
an average. What's an average amount?
Average set is not much for me. We're like 45 minutes. Right,
so that's what I'm saying. Like, so if you peg a starry flounder or a char or something like that, by the time that you're reeling your net in, they're still alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's enough to where you can pop them out, throw them back over.
Yeah.
They're good.
It's super clean fishery.
Yeah. And,
like, draggers are what? That's the bad one where they literally, and I hate using that word, but they have these big nets and they drag them on the bottom of the ocean. They get everything. And then they just sort through what they want and throw the rest down the shit chute is what they call it.
Yeah.
But that's way more damaging for the ground, the ecosystem.
The sea bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
The sea floor. Yeah. But
salmon's super clean. We don't get anything bad.
Right. And so where did we spin off from that?
Where did we spin off? We were talking about picking.
Oh, yeah. So the nets, picking. Yeah. So
so the salmon get caught because they don't have reverse.
Right.
They swim into your net.
Yep.
And they get caught by their gills.
Yep.
And so you pull the net in. And the fish are hanging from their gills. And what you have to do is pop the mesh and kind of twist the gill a little bit, and then it falls down on the boat.
Yes. And they're typically, you know, so I won't say typically. A lot of the times, they're not stuck too bad.
Well, you have a standard stuck.
Yes.
You have a stock. I call this stock. And then you
the easy just like reach your fingers in, pop them.
That's the
they
one
fall
you,
right
that's
out.
That's the one you give the. That's the one you give the new guys.
And that makes you feel like a boss.
Did you call the? You have then. There's all these variants, and then you have the basket case.
Yes, where they hit the net and then they jump over the net,
and then, they spin,
and then somehow they jump over it again.
And sometimes they'll have a friend that's doing the same thing with them. So there's two of them in this.
Basket of webbing.
Yeah.
Just imagine like being in a very large hammock with your friend and then twisting yourself up as your friend twisted themselves up, and then you spin around each other and now you're stuck. And how do you untangle yourself? Yeah. It's crazy. And there's nothing worse than, you know, this happened a couple times, you know, right? You're sitting there and you've got, you know, two or three sockeyes that are all tangled up, and you've got them right next to the wheel because, like, you've just literally got fish that are hanging out of the water.
And
they're not in the water.
The wheel's the propeller.
Yes. And you've got, like, so much tension that's on that part of the net that's off the front of the boat before it gets to the water. And, like, any little shake, you know, they're going to fall. And, you know, here's the thing. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you're a fisherman, right, you know, like, oh, it's an 8-pound sockeye and it costs $1.50.
Yeah.
You know, that's $10 that basically just got away.
Yeah.
$12. So for every fish that gets away, that's lost money. And it all boils back to, like we were saying, like the state might give you 2 hours. They might give you 6 hours. They might give you 8. They might give you 24. You just don't know. So you just literally have to make hay while the grass grows.
Mm-hmm.
And so losing fish because you got a, you know, jammed up net, or you got a green deckhand, or, you know, if you're like my first time out on that boat, man, like you better get with the show.
You got to get fast.
Or get the hell out of the way. Or have enough humility to be like, dude, I can't even begin to get after this one. And it's not a big deal, but I'm not going to sit there and waste 10 minutes trying to pick a fish out of the net.
Well, and your captain won't let you. He'll quickly grab the fish. If he's in the deck, or the first mate or whoever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can't. Greenhorns, I've seen, they're new. They don't know what's going on. And they sometimes take offense to someone else taking their project out of their hands and getting the fish out because they know how to do it, and we don't have time.
You literally don't have time.
Now's not the time for you to learn this project.
Right. Yeah. You will learn as you go. You're going to have plenty
more
opportunities.
There's more coming.
Don't worry.
But there's about 10 standard moves on how to get a fish out of the net.
Yep.
Varying from this classic to like more complex ones. And it's fun watching as you have your deckhands come and learn with you. You know, I've had deckhands with me for 7-8 years and watching the progression.
Yep.
And it's always fun to watch someone learn a new move and then they try to overuse it because they're like excited about the new right. move. And it's like, it's that's
you just got to get the head clear like, and then work from there as you know. And you've again, you've got 14 years on me picking fish, but like, I mean, if I learned anything,
18 because I was a deckhand for 2 years before I bought the
so clearing the head,
yeah,
you know, and from there you can work your way around, but you got to start somewhere, you know,
yeah,
you got this mess of fish, and obviously their head is the way that they are streamlined.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't want to start pulling on the tail because now you're going to be pulling against fins and everything else. So
right.
you can get that head cleared.
Clear the head and pull them through.
And then just start pulling or worst case scenario.
Unless it's a
fatty. Worst case scenario, you're cutting your net and there's nothing that pisses you off more because then when you're on your limited amount of downtime, you're mending net.
Yeah.
Which... My last year that I was fishing was when I learned how to
mend,
which yeah. actually was really cool because the deckhand that I actually, he was, I guess what you want to call, like he is now a captain.
Oh, cool.
But, he was like, I'd call the first mate when I was on the boat. He was a pretty salt to the earth dude. Like when I think about like this dude, like given the chance, probably could have been a pirate, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, this guy could mend net so fast. Like, you know, taught me more different knots and shortcuts on knots. And, you know, it's kind of, it's funny. You don't really think about, like, knots that much
no.
until you're on a boat. And knots make a whole lot of sense when you're on the water because of what they their purpose is, right? Whether yeah. you want the knot to slide, not slide, you know, slide a little bit, not slide a lot. Like, it's pretty cool. I've always been fascinated with knots, and I learned more about, you know, mending nets and those knots and the method of, oh, you know, if it's torn this way, you got to go this way, and then you reconnect, and you basically just rebuilding, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, because, I mean, the nets get beat up.
Yeah.
And they're expensive.
Yes.
I don't know what the new price is now. I haven't bought a new one in a while. They're probably about $1,800 for a 50. And
yeah.
then you're always fishing three, so.
Right.
It's expensive.
It's worth it to limp, you know, to fix them as long as
you
can.
Yeah, you try to keep them fixing, but you also have to keep your crew happy and rested, so
yes.
sometimes you just swap them out,
yep.
you know. So you might go through 12 to 15 of these nets per year.
Yeah.
You can rebuild them. You
yeah,
know.
But in the midst, when you are at war,
yeah,
like given the cost, like in the sanity. I mean, yeah. and as a captain, like
that's the hardest part of the captain is like you're juggling all these balls in the air and you have to find the optimal efficiency between happiness, optimal fish caught and expenses.
Yeah.
It's like
you're managing it all.
It's a tough trifecta.
It is not an easy job.
No.
And you probably don't have a true appreciation for it until you're in that seat. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I can wrap my head around it, and I would probably enjoy being captain, but like I also don't know what type of captain I would actually be. Would I be one that would be more sentimental for my crew, or would I push them hard, or like,
well,
I mean, it's a balance.
You change.
Man.
You
yeah.
would try them all.
Yeah. And it varies because, you know, with your crew, I guess.
Yeah. And it changes with your age and where you're at with your own, I don't know, mentality of life and everything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would change. I've been a captain for the 16 years, and I can think of three distinct variants of me being a captain. I'm the same person, but I've captained three different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always evolving.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to learn how to change, too.
Yeah.
Because the fishery does as well.
You think you're going to do it for life?
I don't know.
Dude, I mean, I would say it's a young man sport, but I also look at it and I say,
I don't know if it's young man sport. Like the guys bringing in the highliners,
right?
They're not young.
But that's what I was getting at.
They're not young.
I would want to call it a young man sport, but like I sit there and I see some of these old salty boss, like, and they get after it.
They get it.
It's experience, of course, right? They know the best spots.
Yeah.
Because that bay
and the techniques.
Yeah. That bay is just like any other body of water. Fish historically go to certain places at certain times, and if you've done it enough, you can give or take more or less make a prediction, a calculated gamble, if you want to call it. Like, because you know how it is out in the bay, like, you don't know exactly where they're going to be, minus like looking at where other boats are, like, but you've got your spots, right? You know, like, yeah, like, given this weather, given this current, swing, like, there's a possibility I'm going to hit some fish if I go over here, because again, you know, you're burning fuel, you know, you got your crew on deck. Like, you got to find fish. I mean, you don't want to make a run all the way to the flats over there if you're not going to think you're going to hit some fish. You might as well just sit in the damn mouth of the knack-knack and wait for them to come if you're too scared. So,
and that gets you into the different style of the boats. So right. There's a classic Bristol Bay boat, which is slow and seaworthy, and they limp along at, like, 8 knots.
Right.
And then you have this like new school idea that's not even new school. It came out in like around the 80s, but they're called jet boats.
Right.
And they're basically skiffs with a little cabin on top. Those guys go fast. So they can zip around. They can go 30 knots.
Right.
I think there's one boat out there that goes 40 now.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, if you want... There's different parts of the tide where it's advantageous to fish in different spots.
Right.
So you're trying to be optimal in fishing in this area because it's good, but you know in 1 hour it's going to be really good in this spot, and that spot's 8 miles away, and my boat goes 8 miles an hour, so I need to leave an hour before it's going to be good. That means leaving good fishing now. I mean, the fishing's good now, but I'm going to leave that and not fish for a full hour and go to a new spot because I'm predicting it's going to be better fish there. But there's these fast boats where they can keep fishing where it's good now for 45 more minutes and then zip over there in 15 minutes and meet me at the same time.
Yep.
In those
but
boats.
That gets into the point, though, of like, it's this like kind of the safety gamble, right? Because those jet skiffs, you know.
Well, they're a little trigger happy.
Yeah.
So they can fish what we call radio fish. So so we're all talking to each other. Well, we have these groups, groups of friends that 5 to 10 to 20 people kind of decide they're gonna fish
friends
and fish together and help each other. And hey, this is where I'm at. This is what I'm catching. What are you getting? All that kind of stuff. And like kind of spread out a bit. And these jet boats, if you have a fast boat, it's easy to be like, hey, my last set was 3,000 pounds to like, ooh, you go over there, but those fish have since they've gone up river. So having a slow boat has the advantage of like slow and steady wins the race. And you'd like keep working the water that you're in right now.
Right. Versus the dude that can zip from spot to spot to spot, and you know, it's just kind of like who's the risk taker.
And they burn a lot of fuel.
You know, payouts can be big,
yeah,
but it's a gamble. You know, it's who has that kind of gambling mentality. I mean, and you know, I would probably say that like the guy that I fished with for a few years, like he had a fast boat. But the boat that he bought was originally designed for when you could fish in the river.
Yeah.
And so it was a flat bottom jet drive.
Yeah.
I mean, this boat will get in. I mean, it is a 19,000 pound boat, but it will get in 4 feet. 3 feet of water.
It'll go less than that.
But like if you're floating and you got fish, I mean, you're drawing a lot of water.
Yeah.
But like it was literally meant to fish in the mouth of these rivers or even up in the rivers. But the state, what was that? How many years ago was that where they stopped allowing people to fish up in the rivers? I mean, it was a while ago.
Yeah, I can explain that. What happened was for whatever reason, the Kwijak, so the Naknek, this is going to be boring for everyone except for us, but the Naknek Kwijak River. Sorry. No, it's good. The Naknek Kwijak River, it's a two river system. Mm-hmm. And the Kwijak was doing very poor, and I'm not sure why. So instead of fishing in the traditional area where you fish in the big river mouth and catching Kwijak fish, they cut that off, and you could only fish in the Naknek section,
right,
which is really, really shallow, and mm-hmm. that's what that boat was designed for.
Yep.
So I fished that area 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a Naknek. But
yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, now for whatever it's worth, I mean, it's Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. It's going to ebb and flow, like with everything.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a new book that came out. I don't know, again, if how much you listen to other podcasts and stuff,
sure,
but
I
that
do, yeah.
Mark Kurlansky's just, he came out with a book. It's called Salmon. Mm. And it's all about the salmon fishery, what was originally the global salmon population. What people don't realize, because I mean honestly they've been dead for hundreds of years, they used to get salmon up the Rhine River in Germany.
Huh.
Atlantic salmon used to run all the way up into Germany. They used to run all the way up into France. They used to run all the way up into Spain. They used to run all the way up into England. I mean, all of these rivers were unbelievable Atlantic salmon fisheries. But, you know, you call it human encroachment, overfishing,
pollution,
all these factors, you know, impact salmon. And it was interesting because the guy's theory on all of it is, and again, it's just, you know, from, you know, one scientist to another to, you know, each their own theory, but he put it to a very simple way. So basically, wild caught salmon are a barometer of our ocean's health because they're so sensitive, right? You know, at one point in time, we used to have like wild populations of trout in the Chattanooga area. You know, obviously we still have wild populations of trout up in the Smoky Mountains, but it's been through restorative efforts. You know, once logging and mining and all that stopped, you know, they came back, you know, because they literally replaced them. Naturally, they were yeah. gone. They were extinct. But he brings up a good point about that. You know, like, you know, there are still, you know, certain rivers in France that will get salmon, Atlantic, wild Atlantic salmon. The only river that is, you know, like on the Atlantic, on the United States eastern seaboard, one of the only rivers that still gets wild Atlantic salmon is the Penobscot in Maine. And they are on the endangered species list. If you catch one, like it is, you better do not take that fish out of the water. You unhook that thing and you let it go immediately. Like they are doing everything they can to find a way to keep these fish alive, because once they're gone, I mean, they're gone. And then you get into this whole discussion of like hatchery fish and what that looks like. And, you know, it's my opinion on hatchery fish is, you know, they're basically a Band-Aid on a broken bone. They make it seem like everything's okay. You know, it's great because there's still fish for sport fishermen to catch, but like you're just kicking the can down the road. You're not solving the problem. Why are these fish dying? Why are these fish not coming home? Like there's a reason. There's an environmental reason that they can't continue to live. And it's because of humans, you know, and it's, so the guys, you know, boiled down to what this Mark was saying was basically that it had a lot to do with greenhouse gases. And I mean, I don't have enough of an education to tell you what, you know, the effects of greenhouse gases. I know it's not good, but, he basically, it had something to do with the carbon dioxide from greenhouse gases creates a lack of something that these wild Pacific salmon need to survive. And if the greenhouse gases keep growing at the rate that it's growing, at a certain point, it will meet a threshold where there will be too much of that. And I think it had something to do with, like, I think it was maybe some type of algae that grows, like, out in the ocean. And it consumes, because that algae consumes a certain amount of oxygen, it prevents something that, you know, just, it trickles down that food chain, right? And so that was his theory. It was basically, is that salmon, at the end of the day, something that we can visualize. I can't visualize a krill out in the ocean or an algae bloom out in the ocean, but, like, I can visualize a salmon in my river.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, not a salmon.
Or not a salmon in my river. Yeah. So, and that has to do with, you know, so that's why he's like, it's a very good barometer of our ocean's health. So, I just hope that people have, you know, as they learn more, you know, they'll eat more. They'll want to protect them.
Yeah.
Because fish farms suck, you know? Fish farms are just like these.
Why are they bad? Tell me about fish
farms.
Well,
okay. I mean, first off, don't not eat salmon if you feel like it's out of your price point, right? If you got a choice and if you want to eat salmon and you can afford farm-raised $7 pound salmon, eat it. How? Eat it, like, because it's good for you. Like, it's better for you from a health perspective than it is eating red meat or anything like that every day.
And, I mean, I think Aldi's has it for $10 a pound frozen all the time. I think that's their standard price.
Yeah.
So it's like maybe $2 more than the farm stuff.
Yeah. I mean, so if you can afford a choice, eat wild caught. Absolutely. Like, it's a no brainer. Like, the health benefits of a wild caught fish from a farm raised fish. And, you know, yeah, you're going to get your omega-3s from both of them, but from your farm raised fish, you're going to get a higher amount of omega-6s, which are the bad fatty acids. That's that saturated fat that's not good for you. And that's what comes from that fish pellet food diet that they're eating versus that wild caught fish that's eating.
Yeah. So the farm fish are actually eating other fish, ground up waste product of fish. Is that what you're
talking about? And a plethora of other things. Yeah. Additives that make up the bulk of their diet. Yeah. I mean, like,
and they dye the fish.
Yes. So the reason a wild caught salmon is the color is that it is that, like, reddish pinkish hue is because of that natural diet in the ocean that stems from its, I can't remember what it's, carotene or something like that. It's that supply, or that it's that food chain, right? Like, that it's the krill that the herring get eaten by the salmon, and that's how they get that color in their flesh, versus this fish that's kept in a pen and it doesn't get that. And it also has to do with movement, right? So you think about, everybody can relate to a chicken, right? You got a chicken breast and you got a chicken leg. You got white meat, you got dark meat. The reason there's dark meat is because it has more blood flow, because that's such a highly moving part. Salmon that live in the ocean, that swim friggin' 15,000, 20,000 miles in their lifetime, those are muscles that are pumping some serious blood. Like, it's dark, it's gonna be red. And, like, man, you know what that piece of sockeye looks like when you pull it off the side of that fish? I mean, it is red. It's beautiful. I mean, it's beautiful. It's red. It's red gold.
They call it red gold. I was wondering if you'd say that. Yeah.
It's red gold.
Red gold.
That's a great documentary for anybody that, like, wants to learn more about Pebble Mine. It's called Red Gold. It really gives you a new perspective on salmon, wild salmon.
Yeah.
It's awesome, dude. Man, I'm jazzed that you're going. So you're leaving Thursday.
Thursday. You want to come? Last chance.
Oh, dude. No, I need to stay married and happy with my kids. But if you're still after it in a few years,
okay,
ask again.
Yeah, once your kids get old enough, maybe they need a job.
Oh, I hope. Like, you know, I'll never force my kids into anything they would never want to do. But if my kid ever expressed interest in fishing or guiding or commercial fishing, man, I would do everything in my power to continue to encourage them to do it.
Do you still have your pilot's license?
Yeah.
Cool.
So I can't say that I would consider it like active. I mean, like once you have a pilot's license, so as long as you continue to keep your medical certificate active, you technically have a pilot's license. But technically I could go get in a plane, but what I would have to do is I would have to get in the plane with a flight instructor.
Yeah.
And do basically 3 takeoffs and landings and a handful of other maneuvers to demonstrate that I'm still a competent, safe pilot.
Yeah.
And then in order to fly with passengers, I would have to, you know, jump in the plane by myself, demonstrate all those same things, maneuvers, landings, stalls, etc. And then, yeah, I could fly anywhere, but you know, I haven't been in the left seat of a airplane in 2 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. For the only reason is just that, you know, my view on flying was basically like, if I'm not going to fly a lot or, you know, if I'm not going to be consistent and proficient, I've got no business being in the air, because if you're not proficient with, when you're defying a human element, like, here, come on, dude, we're in the air. We're playing against gravity and everything.
We're not supposed to fly.
We're not supposed to fly. Like, dude, I mean, like, if you're not being proficient, you're going to become a statistic. And I'm not trying to become a statistic. You know, now, as I have more flexibility and free time, you know, what's the first thing that I'm going to do? Hell yeah, I'm going to go get back in that airplane.
Yeah. Because
it is an incredible feeling, and it is, you know, there's a lot of, you know, freedom and exhilaration and adrenaline. And, you know, it's just something that I have a pretty busy mind. And there's a lot of things that are going on when you're flying that you are managing, whether it's gauges, weather, airspace, you know, comms with towers, other airplanes. There's a lot going on, which I loved, you know, like there was always something to do. I might be ADD. I don't know. I mean, I probably am, but like, I loved it, you know, but so yeah, as soon as I get some free time in life again,
I want to, have you ever had any close calls in the airplane?
Yeah. You know, you spend enough time and like enough years in airplanes, whether you're in the pilot seat or not. I mean,
do you have like a specific story?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, so this was in my guiding tenure. So this would have been probably like, this is what actually spurred me to get my pilot's license. It was in 2000 and, it was that 2011 season. I got my license in the fall of 2011, late fall. We were flying home from a river that was out in kind of near Kodiak Island. So you've got...
Did you get to fly on Kodiak?
I never went to Kodiak, and there's a reason. So we were on like... You know, we were in Southwest Alaska, right? Like what you would consider like the Iliamna area of Alaska,
yeah,
which is separated by Cook Inlet, Shelikof Strait, and you got Anchorage on that eastern side. Kodiak Island is kind of in between there. We used to fish a lot of rivers that were on the southwest side that are in Katmai National Park. The reason we never fished Kodiak is because of the danger of flying a piston driven airplane across that much open water. And the thing is like, yeah, like 9 times out of 10, no problem, you're going to make it. But a piston driven aircraft is just like a car engine, right? Like gaskets blow, rods break, like, if you lose an engine coming across Shelikof Strait and the weather is shit and you got 4-foot swells even, and your plane goes down in that, you're in 50-degree water. I don't care if you call the Coast Guard as you're going down. If they dispatch a helicopter, A, if you survive the crash, great. Now you're in 55-degree water. maybe there's going to be a rescue. Sure, you might have your little yellow life jacket on, but you're dealing with a 20-foot tidal swing. Like, the chances of being found are not great. Like, it's risk, reward, benefit for catching a fish for sport fishermen, not worth it. So that's a long way of saying we were coming home from one of those rivers. We were coming, like, we kind of, like, if the weather is good, you can cut through the mountains. And you don't ever have to go across any part of Shelikof. You can just cut through the mountains. But if you got high winds or turbulence, you can't run these little planes through these mountains. You just get your ass kicked. It'll break your plane, literally. So you have to swing out. We swung out over Shelikof. We knew the weather was bad, so we were at about 6,000 feet. Right as we, I mean, I'm not kidding you. Right as we got over mainland, we blew a jug. Jug is a nickname for a cylinder in an airplane, a piston. Blew a jug, oil blows across the screen of the windshield of the airplane. And it's just kind of like, dude, you're going down. Like, it's just a matter of where do you want to go down at this point. Again, I wasn't in the left seat. Thank God. This is, again, what... So Martin is in the left seat.
Yeah, the mentor.
The mentor who's got, I'm just going to spitball probably, this is now 8 years after that year. I mean, he's probably got 25 or 30,000 hours flying a Beaver. Probably one of the most experienced Beaver drivers, if not in the state, definitely in that area. You know, we had one of the other airplanes from the lodge was with us. He radios Dave, says basically, hey, Dave, like, we just blew a jug. I'm picking water. You know, we're going down. Stay above me. Just, you know, you make calls if something goes wrong. We start coming down. And basically, once you lose your engine in an airplane, you're basically left with what's called your glide rate, your best glide rate. How do you keep positive airflow over this to where you can keep flying and without stalling the airplane? With a Beaver on floats with the load we had, basically, we had to maintain an airspeed of about 92 miles an hour in order to stay flying. So you're at 6,000 feet, 92 miles an hour, descending downward. You better just start picking what lake or whatever. So Martin had picked a lake. We were just kind of doing circles over it as we're starting to descend. You know, we had guests in our airplane too. You know, and they're kind of like, what's going on, guys? And you don't want to be like, we're crashing. We might fucking die, right? But, like, you're just like,
cool. Didn't they see the oil on the windshield?
Maybe. I don't know. Like, I mean.
But they were still a little naive. They didn't quite know.
Yeah, you know, it just depends on who you have in the airplane. These guys didn't really seem to have an understanding. But, like, so you're kind of, like, trying to keep the peace. Like, you know, you don't want to turn around and be like, say your Hail Marys. Yeah. Like, we're going down. I'm sitting up in the front seat like, I'm so sorry for everything I've ever done or said. Like, geez. Oh, man. So we come down. Martin's, again, great pilot, sees, all right, I'm going to set up this way. I'm going to land on this lake because it's longer. But as he gets lower and lower, you know, we're, you know, a couple hundred feet off the ground, he quickly realizes now that he can see the wind direction on the water of the lakes. Like, the long lake's actually not the better lake because he was going to have to accept a crosswind.
Yeah.
So he chooses the shorter lake, but it was a straight head-on wind, knowing that he could probably get the plane stopped in that distance. And even if we hit shore before we were fully stopped, we wouldn't be going at a speed enough. That's like, these are the things that are going through your mind as a pilot. Yeah. I mean, you're trying to stay like 3-4 steps ahead of like what's actually happening. And so picks the lake. I mean, dude, if it was anybody else, probably wouldn't be sitting here having this interview. And dude puts it right down. I mean, I'm talking like, I can still vividly remember looking out the right window of the front seat of that Beaver and seeing just these jagged granite rocks, like right on the edge of the lake. And I mean, we're just straight up like feet, 2-3 feet over these things. And he puts this thing right into the lake. I mean, pulls all the power. I mean, there's really no power at that point. The prop was going enough, but he knew that, like, and like he gave it like the last bit of juice that he could give it right as we were clearing those boulders to just push us. Came over it, hit the water, leveled straight, and literally, you've got no brakes, right? Because you're on water. You got no grav. You got no brakes. When the plane literally like did one of those like slow nudges into the bank on the other side, like just enough to where you kind of like were like, ugh, like that, like not enough to even realize. You're just like, ugh. You're just like, I looked at him. I'm like, are you kidding me? Did this just like, and he's just looking at me like, I mean, and I just like turn around to the guys in the back of the airplane. I'm like, we good? Y'all want to like get out? Y'all ready to have like a beer?
Yeah.
You want a beer?
Jeez.
I need a beer. Like I need a beer. Like, does anybody got any cigarettes around here? Like, yeah. I'm trying to like calm myself down right now. But yeah, sure enough though, Dave, the other guy that was in the airplane above us, radared in. You know, we talked to him. We're like, we're good. He flew his guests home, dropped them, refueled, flew back out. Dropped off an airplane mechanic.
I was gonna say, did you just rebuild it there?
Literally,
yeah.
He picks up the mechanic that we have. He has on staff. The dude throws, you know, literally like a canvas duffel, throws all his tools, a new cylinder, literally throws it all into a canvas bag. They fly out there. They drop the mechanic off. Dave flies me and the three guests back to the lodge. These dudes are soaking in hot tubs and saunas and eating crackers and drinking liquor and stuff.
Yeah,
and no chilling. Shit, you know, here it is in the middle of like, you know, July. It's like 12:30 at night. It's kind of light like it is right now, you know. It's kind of this dusky look. You hear that hum of that beaver coming. It's and no kidding, like 4 hours later. Like, this guy pops a jug, puts a new one in, fires it up, takes off, comes home.
Well, that's Alaska.
It's Alaska. Yeah. Just get used to it, man. Like, I can't tell you enough. Like, it's, once it's in your blood, it's in your blood.
Man, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, for all of you that have not been to Alaska, go to Alaska. For all you kids or people that need a job, holler at Luke.
Yeah.
He can give you a job.
I'm good this year. Yeah. Don't holler at me.
Yeah. All right.
I'm trying to chill right now.
Nice. Well, yeah. It's awesome, man. I'm jazzed for you. I hope you have a safe season.
Thanks. Yeah, it should be good.
Yeah. Well, anytime you want to talk fish,
yeah.
Holler at me when you get back.
I will.
For sure.
I will.
There's probably gonna be a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
About fish in general. Yeah. You know. If you want to set some aside for me, and then we can tell all of our Chattanooga people how you can get some Luke Swab
from
fish.
The guy from, yeah.
Yeah, we can. What's the name of your boat again?
Seahawk.
Seahawk.
Yep.
Come on, bring some Seahawk sock.
Yeah, we'll see. It's difficult.
Yeah.
We'll,
I know. It's not so easy. It is a wild maybe supply chain.
Maybe I can get Tony a load.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
He could.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. We can, if we really want to make it happen.
Yeah. If I'm a knack and like it works out, I could get,
we can make it happen.
That'd be
for
cool.
Sure.
It'd be super cool to have some people of Chattanooga branded sockeye salmon.
Yeah. You know, this is something we've been talking about, and obviously we've got this like ridiculous, well, not ridiculous, our current global situation of COVID, right?
Yeah.
So, but maybe when you get back, you know, maybe things will be at a better place.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to do what I would call like a fish party, right? So I just want to have like a gathering, you know, my friends, your friends, their friends, like whatever. I don't care if it's 20 people or if it's 100 people, man. And bring some fish off your boat and like, you know, like cut them into steaks or fillet them, fire up grills, fire up the ovens, do some sashimi. Like,
sounds,
man,
it's so good.
It's awesome. I mean, I know you like literally the last thing you want to do when you're like, you're on the boat is just like eat some fish, right?
You know, I eat it. I love it. Yeah. I actually don't get sick.
Yeah.
My crew guys always, start, you know,
yeah,
saying, do we have to have salmon?
Like, yeah.
I love it.
Dude, I forgot. I brought you this too.
What do you got?
Where is it? There it is. Seasoning blend.
Oh, cool.
Designed it specifically for
sockeye. Cool.
It's awesome.
Thank you.
Yes. Actually, the guys at Alchemy Spice here in town made it for me.
Wow.
Take that. Yeah. Break the seal. Open it. It smells. It's awesome.
Okay. I'm going to open it. Right
yeah.
Now.
Just open it real quick.
Yeah.
Just take a whiff. I think.
You're going to make me hungry. I didn't have
dinner yet. Yeah. I didn't either. So we'll.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Taste it. You'll know how good it's going to be on salmon.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah. So
how do you normally cook salmon?
It just depends, but like for the most part,
dang, that's good.
Yeah. You know, you sprinkle some of that on it and you can throw it on the grill. I always like to tell people, you know, the difference between wild caught and farm raised is that it's just going to cook quicker. It doesn't have that fat content that a farm raised fish does. So I like to try to steer people to a higher temperature, but for a lower time. So a good rule of thumb, what I always tell people is 400 degrees, a piece of sockeye at 400 degrees, 6 minutes most, right? You know, fish is just like any other, like piece of red meat. You know, you can have it rare, medium, well done. Like, you're doing a piece of sockeye injustice if you cook it well done.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It's like you'd never cook a friggin' $35 ribeye well done. No way, man. Like, yeah. I mean, maybe you would. I don't know. Dip in some ketchup while you're at it.
There's guys out there.
Well, I know. And I mean, teach their own again. But, yeah. Like, for me, a 400 degree oven, even if it's just salt and pepper, you know, squeeze a lemon for 5-6 minutes. It's going to be this like perfect medium rare. You know, you pull it out of the oven, it's still going to have like a little bit of residual cook time. Like by the time you put it on your plate with your veggies, like it's going to be perfect.
That salt, lemon, pepper.
Yeah.
That's in a hot pan. Yeah. That's how we do it on the boat most of the time.
Yeah.
But we've done everything. It's kind of like that Forrest Gump, like the shrimp scene.
Yeah, exactly. Shrimp, this, shrimp,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, only it's boiled salmon.
But that's the thing, though, is like, again, like, you know, salmon is so universal. Like, you know, people, I think, are, and this is what, again, part of my business now is like trying to educate people on cooking seafood, right? Like, I read an interesting article a couple of weeks ago in the midst, again, of all this COVID, right? So 80% of the population that eats seafood eats it at restaurants.
Oh, they don't cook it.
They don't cook it at home.
Yeah.
Because they're intimidated by it. Huh. And intimidated in the sense that, A, they don't like the way it makes their house smell. B, they don't know how to cook it, you know. And so my job, I feel like, as somebody who is trying to take a small family fisherman's product to the customers, you know, I got to teach them, you know, it's not intimidating. Like, yeah, you can bake a piece of sockeye for 6 minutes and it's going to be delicious. You know, you can also cube it up into some chunks and you can throw it in a skillet and then throw it in a taco shell and it's going to be just as good, if not better than any taco you've ever had. So
then if you have some left over, you can turn it into salmon patties.
Salmon patties. Salmon cakes. I mean, there's so much universal cooking, you know, things that you can do with salmon.
Have you ever had salmon curry?
Yeah, I should have.
It's fantastic.
I've got some killer recipes
for
a salmon curry, yellow curry, and it's so good. Like, you know, just grilled salmon, poached salmon. I mean, dude, it's endless. So don't be scared to cook salmon at home. You know what? You're probably going to screw up the first piece or two, like you do everything.
But then if you overcook it, turn it into salmon cakes. That's how you save it.
Exactly. You know, and if you really screwed it up, like, give it to your dog. If it's so impalatable, give it to your dog. If you don't have a dog, give it to your neighbor's dog. I don't care. Make friends with the neighborhood cat. I don't care, you know, but like, don't let it go to waste. And again, it's new. You're always going to screw something up the first time you do it. So just do it again and do it again. And you know what? Before you know it, you're going to be dialed and you're going to be eating wild caught and you're going to be supporting people like Luke.
Mr. Luke.
Who's a fisherman.
So you told me before we started that you like hunting.
Yeah.
Have you gone out west? Have you done elk hunt or anything exotic or what kind of hunting?
I haven't done a ton of, you know, big game hunting.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of like my passion probably falls more in like birds. I am a huge fan of turkey hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I love turkeys. As far as big game goes, I've never really chased anything other than white-tailed deer, what we have locally here. And honestly, like, you know, I feel like hunters get a bad rap because they're like, oh, we only hunt for horns, trophy hunters, all this, man. Like, I don't, yeah, cool. If I see a big buck, like, yeah, I mean, I'd love to shoot a big buck, but like at the end of the day, like, I legitimately hunt for meat. Like, you know, I love eating venison.
The argument also could be made, it's good to go after the older bucks because they're at the end of the year and they're gonna die the next fall naturally anyway. I mean, I've heard that argument before. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's just to, you know, to each their own. I mean, but, you know, again, it kind of boils back down to, like, states do a really good job managing, you know, they have biologists that are managing deer herd populations.
Yeah, just like the salmon, it's the same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, they have what's called, like, antler restrictions and stuff like that. Antler size is typically a gauge of the age of the animal. Obviously, you don't want to kill so many of the, or harvest so many of the mature animals that are the breeding stock, but you also don't want to, you know, take out too many of the young deer that are growing up to become that mature population. And so, yeah, state regs are awesome. I mean, like, you know, I can't remember what it is in Tennessee. It's just like, it's something like, you know, the if you're going to, you can only harvest X amount of does, which are the female deer. And as far as the male deer go, because male deer can breed multiple females, so I think you're only allowed to harvest maybe like 2 bucks, and those bucks have to meet a certain requirement. And, you know, if you hunt public land, you have to check all your animals in with these, you know, Tennessee TWRA, and same thing goes with Georgia. If you're on private land, you still have to report what you harvest.
And, yeah, and buy the license. And
you buy the license, and the cost of your license, you know, if you're in-state or out-of-state, it all goes to animal land conservation. Yeah. So, like, don't be a jackass and poach. Like, buy a license. Like, again, it all comes back to, like, you know, we're borrowing this land from our grandchildren.
Exactly.
Like, just be a good human.
Yeah.
Just be a good human. That's all. I mean, just want to live in this happy human world.
Man, so that might be a good word to end it on. Be a good human.
Just be a good human.
Should we wrap it up?
Yeah, man. This has been awesome. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for coming over. This was really good. I rarely talk about my fishing job with people because it's hard for people to understand it. So I can talk with you because you've done it.
Right.
And I really appreciate that. And there's not a lot of people in Tennessee that have do my current job that I do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is an extra treat. And like I say, I'm leaving in about 5 days to go up there and do that. But, I've already pre-recorded enough podcasts to come out every Monday, so I won't skip a beat. But yeah, that's what I'm doing for the next 7 weeks.
Be careful.
Thank you.
Have fun.
Thanks for coming over and for all the treats, and I'm going to enjoy this seasoning.
Seriously, if you need more,
okay,
we'll mail it. We can get it there.
Yeah.
Or if you need a couple more jars before you go.
I'll give you my address.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, what is it? Middle of Bristol Bay?
It's like 139 P.O. Box.
Yeah.
Like Alaskan
Highway. We'll just give
road.
You like 5 jars before you go.
I'll do that instead.
That might keep the crew happy.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for coming over. It's great getting to know you. Talk to you.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks. Bye. Well, there you have it. That's my conversation with Thomas Persinger. That was extra special for me, obviously, because being a Bristol Bay captain in Tennessee, it's kind of rare. And to find someone in this my own town that has done that, that's special. So we had a special connection, a special conversation, and I'm going up there and 6 days, and it's a hard job, and mentally I'm trying to get prepared, and this was a treat. I needed this. So I hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Thomas. If you enjoy the podcast in general, I would really appreciate if you left a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. Other than that, listen to the next episode next Monday. Thanks for listening and supporting. Bye.